Accession number 13945, Reel 2.
Mr. Davenport, Reel 2.
Reel 2. I was struggling up the gangway with my kit bag and hammock. It was raining very, very heavy indeed. But when I got on the upper deck, I noticed that the officer of the watch and the quartermaster came across to speak to me, and I handed them over my draft note, and the officer said, "Stay there for a while," and he immediately got hold of the quartermaster and sent him to get two of the boys from the foreign mess to come and help me to carry my kit bag and hammock to the mess I was to join. I thought that was very good indeed. And in fact, there were three or four lads arrived, and they all carried my kit forward into the boys' mess deck. The boys' mess deck, I might say, is right forward and as far down as you could go. There were probably three or four mess tables, all boys. Signal boys, seaman boys, all mixed, and it was quite packed. The accommodation was hammocks, which you could sling, a mess table with wooden forms, and of course you had at the end of the table a contraption, mess traps it was called, for your mess traps, putting your cups, plates, knives and forks and so on. This was a metal container at the end of the table. Then if we would have our meals at the regular times, breakfast, dinner and supper, but this ship was on what they called canteen messing. It was terrible. Some people said it was just what they wanted, but it was not a very good system. It was called canteen messing. The other system was called general messing. Now, the difference is this, that each mess on the canteen messing system, each mess is allocated a certain amount of money, depending on how many are in the mess, and you have to then go and buy your food for the mess from, say, the butcher and from the stores. Now, a lot of people would say that, we don't want to waste too much money on food. Let's just get the bare essentials. And at the end of the month, the paymaster will say, "Oh, you've only spent so much. Now I'll have to give you some money and we'll call it mess savings. So this month you've got all this mess savings. Go and divide it out amongst your pals." And then, of course, the lads would go ashore with all this money and have a great time. Well, of course, that means that you didn't really have much food. On the other system, general messing, and that was always operated on big ships, battleships, big cruisers, this system was whereby the all meals were provided on a system which the paymaster was given so much money from the Admiralty, and he was able to say how much food would go to each mess, and there would be no discussion about whether they could afford to buy tins of peaches or anything like that. The paymaster would say there would be duff for dinner, rice for dinner, or whatever he had decided would be the complete menu, and that would be it. Be no choice at all. So with canteen messing, you did have a choice, but it was not a very good one. And being a young lad, I was always hungry, and I didn't like that system one bit.
So, what duties was the ship carrying out once you joined it?
Once I joined the ship, I reported up onto the bridge, and Chief Yeoman Smith and another Chief Yeoman, for the size of the ship, it was most unusual to have two Chief Yeoman, but we did have a large staff, two Chief Yeoman, probably about four or five Yeoman, probably eight leading hands, which we call killicks, and then you had signalmen, and then ordinary signalmen, and then down to myself, boys. So, when I went upon the bridge, I reported to the chief yeoman, and he told me my duties would be as a dayman. In other words, you'd work during the day only. You were too young, being a boy, you were too young to do night watches. And in fact, you were not allowed to be put on night watches. So you just have to work during the day. You'd stay up on the bridge most of the day. You'd be allowed down for your dinner, of course you would. But then there were all sorts of tasks you had to do. You would have to wait on or assist others who were senior to you to deal with signals, whether it be by light, semaphore, flags or whatever. You had to just do as you were told and assist. First thing in the morning, of course, you had to get up nice and early and go up and scrub the flag deck and the compass platform. All the bright work had to be done. That bright work is all the, you've got a tin of metal polish and look for any bits of brass and go and polish them. And this was a daily task and never halted. And then there was nothing doing at all, usually they would send you away with get a bucket and cloth and a large piece of soap, probably about 8 inches by about 2, yellow soap, put that in the bucket and a cloth and wash the paintwork down. So there was always plenty to do. Now, of course, you had to learn an awful lot more now. There were things like repairing flags. That was not easy, to get onto a sewing machine and repair a flag. That was a difficult one, I thought, and it took some time to learn that one. There were other things, of course, which you were quite capable of, and you were maybe better at because you had done boys' training, because you were alongside chaps who had come into the war, hostilities only, who had had very, very little training, very, very little naval background, knew very, very little and could not be relied upon to read flashing at too fast a speed, for instance. And so there you'd be able to jump in and probably do the job a little bit better than they could. But that was really because of the circumstances at the time.
Did Ceres stay in Mombasa?
At Mombasa, we would be instructed by the senior naval officer ashore to sail and take up convoy escort duties. A lot of these convoys were now moving up from Durban, Cape Town, Durban, Mombasa, and on up to North Africa. Some of the ships were very well-known ships, like the Strathmore, the Strathnava, Orontes, Viceroy of India, Empress of Australia, Duchess of Athol, Andes, Highland Princess, Scythia, Athlone Castle, Esperance Bay, Reno del Pacifico, Duchess of Athol, Strathallan, Durban Castle and Bridgewater. There were many more, of course. These ships would form into lines in a convoy, and together with other escorts, we would escort them up to Aden and along the coast to North Africa to offload troops to take part in the battles that were going on in North Africa.
Were any of the convoys attacked whilst you were with Ceres?
No, the convoys were not attacked when I was on the Ceres and in convoy going through. But other convoys had been attacked by German armed merchant raiders. We were never in that situation. We always had reports coming through by signal that to be expected that a certain armed raider was in a certain position and we were to keep a lookout and so on and so forth. But we never actually came across them. Well, there were many strange dark ships at sea on their own at night which had to be investigated. but they turned out to be ships that had broken down, and they were certainly not enemy ships, but they did cause alarm because, of course, we would approach the ship and challenge them, then we would put the searchlights onto them, and we would fire rockets over them and continually circle, even making smoke screens. And it was very difficult to get any response from them at times. But as far as the convoy being attacked, no, we did not have that unfortunate experience.
Was the Ceres an efficient ship, do you think?
The Ceres was a very, very efficient ship. We had 5-6-inch guns, and these guns were always being exercised by the gunnery crews. I did say just now that the convoys were not attacked, but we did have on many occasions off Italian Somaliland an aircraft coming over which would always keep at a very safe height, and our AA gunners would always be firing away at them, but they never came down close enough to drop bombs. We had 3-inch HA guns on either side of the ship, but there were no bombs dropped, and the aircraft that were up there always kept at a very safe height. We always thought that they were out spotting.
Was your time aboard Ceres a happy time or not?
Yes, a very happy time. It was my first real ship, of course, and during the time I was on there, I moved up from signal boy up into the signalman's mess. The signalman's mess was now, you might say, on the upper deck, really, and you could look out the portholes, and, oh dear, it was really marvellous. And I would say that the mess itself, we must have had probably about 20. There were signalmen mainly, but we had one or two others which were chefs. Chefs, well, there were not sufficient of them to have their own mess, so they were victual with us. And, of course, this was a good move, really, because the galley, the chefs, well, this was our lifeline. Well, we had the best people in the mess, and they looked after us very, very well indeed. I did say earlier, I did omit to mention, that we were talking about the aircraft coming over and that our HA gunners were firing away and so on. At the same time, that was off the Italian Somaliland, places like Mogadishu and Kismayu. We also experienced at that time firing from the shore batteries, but they never got close enough to hit the ship. We did go into Kismayu Harbour to investigate the shipping there and came out again. We went into Brava and also Mogadishu. We went into these harbours looking for enemy ships. But it was only during the day that the shore batteries would have a go at us, but there were never the shells never landed close enough to give us any worry.
Now, you were still in this ship in December 1941 when the Japanese came into the war. Did that make any difference to you?
I don't think it made any difference to us at all, because our duties and everything were exactly the same. We just had to carry on doing our convoy work. We just were told a little bit about it and about Singapore, and we were informed about other ships would now be on their way from UK to the Far East. But it didn't really make any difference to us, really.
Can you tell me how it was that you eventually in 1942 came to leave Ceres?
Well, the ship was now heading for a refit. And this refit was going to be done in Simonstown. And the ship docked in Simonstown. And because there were so many junior rates on board, that is junior signalmen, signal boys and so on, that they decided that rather than leave us on board the ship, we would be better put to work in the signal offices ashore. And so we were drafted to the Admiral's Office signal station in Simonstown. We were put into watches to keep a watch, and we just did really general main signal office daemon's duties, typing, duplicating, telephone, passing messages to ships in harbour, and that was the main work for us at that time.
How did you like that? As
well,
being,
I can tell
compared with being at sea.
Well, yes, I must say that this was a complete change for us, a complete change. We did see another side of life. Here we were on the telephone passing messages to various ships, and we would be interrupted on the telephone by some young lady now and again from the exchange to say, I haven't heard of you before, who are you? And so on. These were the South African young white ladies that obviously looking for boyfriends and so on. So there was a lot of silly old chat went on, and something we'd never heard of. We'd been so strict, especially on telephone lines. So that one, I always remember, did surprise us. We couldn't believe it. And we were told by the chief yeoman at the time that if this ever happened, we were to take note of whoever it was and the time and report it. However, that was just that side of it. After we got into the watchkeeping routine, we found out that there were an awful lot of invitations sent to us by people ashore in Simonstown. They wanted to entertain us, to take us to dinner, ask us what part of the country we came from, and just generally wanted to talk about England, or I should say Great Britain, and anything at all that we could tell them. They found it so interesting, and they were very, very kind to us. They even organised swimming parties when we were off watch. It never cost us anything. They'd come and pick us up and take us to the beach, which is only a few yards away, really. And they were very kind to us indeed. So we did see another side of life altogether. The people in Simonstown were ever so good, really.
Did they say anything to you about the cost of the war? About, were they all in favour of the war?
Now, that one, I wouldn't like to give an honest answer about that. Of course, as I say, a lot of it really at the time, to answer questions like that, you see, at my age, I wasn't really sort of in that sort of conversation, because I was really enjoying life too much. Remember that there was a war on back in UK. I was having nothing to do with that. I was out in the East Indies, and it was sunshine, oranges and things that the UK had forgotten all about. We were really enjoying ourselves. That is when we were ashore. Once we went to sea, of course, that was a different matter. But when I was ashore, well, all we spoke about was anything but the war. So I think really that they felt they were too far away to be worried about the war. The one thing that I do remember was that a lot of the men were going up to North Africa, and they were joining up and going to North Africa. So quite a few of the families were now without their fathers, without their husbands, and they were going away to the war. But it was quite a different atmosphere from UK.
How did you come to join submarine service whilst you were in Simonstown?
Yes, that was quite a different thing happened to me than had ever happened before. I was just happened to be in the main signal office on duty one afternoon, and I was duplicating on one of these spirit duplicators, methylated spirits, and rolling off the signal. Now, we used to roll off signals and never read the things, but I happened to read this one, and here it said that there was a Dutch submarine required a signalman. and this would be sailing from Simonstown to the UK shortly. I thought, well, I must volunteer for this. I like this one. And, of course, I requested, along with others, to see if I could join this 019 and sail back to UK. Now, at the time, I didn't realise it, that there had been a bit of a set-to in Cape Town. There had been some Dutch merchant ships in Cape Town, and there had been some trouble ashore, drunken brawls and fighting. And the next day after that, I joined this Dutch submarine 019. I didn't think it was a good time to join at all, and I nearly backed out of it. But I was very lucky because I was picked to go simply because I had done 2.5 years abroad and I must have been due to go home. Apart from, and also, of course, I was a very junior rated, so they were not losing anything too important when they lost me to the services there. So when I went on the 019, I discovered that I was the only English chap on board, or the only Royal Navy British chap on board, and the only other person that was English speaking was the liaison officer, whose name was Lieutenant Bill Robjohns from New Zealand, and he was a very good chap. He quite different from the normal way you're received by naval officers. He really made me at home, and I was made most welcome by him and the Dutch signalman called Bill Korver.
How do normal RN officers greet you then?
Well, normally, of course, when you're greeted by a naval officer, you sort of salute and you tell him you're reporting for duty and so-and-so, and that's the end of it. You don't really have anything extra to say. At that time, they didn't anyway. But that was a general way of things. It would probably be a long time later on that when you were maybe a bit older that they might speak to you a little bit more civilly. But generally, when you were a young lad, they didn't really want to spend too much time talking to you about anything. Unless you were in their particular department and they got to know you after a while. But they generally would not bother too much with junior ratings unless it was strictly business.
Sorry, I interrupted you with your the warmth of your greeting by the signal staff.
The signal staff, the warmth of the greeting by Lieutenant Robjohns, he was the liaison officer on board the 019, and also Bill Korver, who was the signalman. Now, Bill Korver could speak very, very good English, and he was older than myself, but he was a jolly type, and he soon introduced me to all the other lads and tried his best to make me feel at home.
What condition was the ship in?
Oh, well, the ship was in a very good condition indeed. I've always found that the Dutch are very, very clean. Their ships are very clean. They're always cleaning. They're always working at it. And everything was spotless. Quite different, I thought, from our old Navy, which although we seem to put time in cleaning, they never seem to appear as clean as the Dutch can make them. Whether we use the wrong materials or what, I don't know. But they were very, very good indeed. And, for instance, when they were cleaning, it was not great big buckets and cloths and so on. They used a small enamel basin, which itself looked very, very clean indeed, and a small cloth, and they would wash the lockers down, which were easy to wash. The floor or the deck in a submarine, instead of the brown quarter scene which you've got in our own submarines and had to be scrubbed with great big scrubbers and so on, they had a finish of a, it would look like a cream and green flecked rubber matting right through. So, and it was very, very light indeed. Now this would be washed every day, every day. And on top of that, there was a mat which would unroll all the way down, so that where you walk through a gangway, you were actually walking on a rubber, on a a coir type mat, which would be on top of a rubber covering again. And this, of course, helped in the submarine itself, where, of course, you had to go to silent routine, and you didn't want a lot of noise made during attack. You had to be as quiet as possible, in addition, of course, to a lot of the tools which were covered with rubber.
Was the ship in good mechanical condition?
The ship was in very good mechanical condition, from what I could understand, although she was due a refit. I think she'd been out there for about 3 years, and she had been based at Surabaya. There were six of that class, I beg your pardon, there were about nine of that class. 019 and 020 were mine layers, and 021, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27 were the same design and tonnage, but were not mine layers. And the latter of the few I mentioned there, they were still on the stocks in Germany when war broke out. The Dutch tried their best to destroy them so that the Germans could not take over. But since the war, of course, we've discovered that the Germans did rebuild a number of those submarines, and they went out on patrol in the Atlantic. But as far as my own submarine was concerned there, the 019 survived from the Japanese invasion of the Dutch East Indies. The 020 was sunk, I believe, in the Gulf of Siam, I'm not sure, but I believe she was sunk there. But the 019 had been in one or two skirmishes before I had joined the submarine, and was now on its way to UK, and it was at Simonstown that she stopped on her way to UK, and that's where I joined it. And from there we did a very, very slow journey home to UK via Freetown, West Africa, Freetown, where we stopped for a few days. We even stopped long enough to have a game of football there at Freetown. We were only on one engine, and then we slowly made our way to Falmouth in Cornwall.